Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we'll be talking to a children's author and music educator about a wonderful little book she's created called Welcome to the Symphony, designed to help young children get excited about the symphony orchestra. In part two of the morning show today, in a related topic, I'm delighted to welcome into our studios Alvaro Garcia, who conducts the orchestras at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Their upcoming concert this weekend is going to feature music of John Williams from the Star Wars movies, and we're going to be talking about that music and what makes it so dramatic and exciting. Stay with us. It's actually one of the few pieces of classical music that probably does not require introduction for most people. Even people with scant interest in classical music or knowledge about it probably have some notion of that being the opening to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Of course, you cannot take that for granted when you are talking about young children. And of course, more and more the sad reality is that classical music is something that more and more youngsters are less and less likely to encounter, which makes it all the more important for those of us who care about classical music to take in hand an exciting new book called Welcome to the Symphony, a musical exploration of the orchestra using Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. This is a book conceived of and written by Carolyn Sloan, who is a highly regarded musician and songwriter with a long resume involving television, theater, and outreach to children. And she is a music educator at the Berklee Carroll School in Brooklyn, New York. So she knows a lot about how to connect with young children when it comes to getting them excited about classical music and getting them to maybe broaden their horizons, let down their resistance, and be willing to encounter classical music and all that it has to offer. This is a beautifully written book. It, at a glance, looks like kind of a standard, colorful children's book, but it has some sound component to it that is really quite intriguing and helpful, beautifully illustrated by James Williamson. And I'm very happy to have the author, Carolyn Sloan, with me for the next few minutes to talk about Welcome to the Symphony. Carolyn Sloan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
Before we get talking about your book, could you just say a word about the Berklee Carroll School and the work that you do there?
Sure. The Berklee Carroll School is a pre-K through 12 college preparatory school. It's an independent school in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I teach music there to grades 2 through 4, and I also oversee the lower school music program as well. I teach chorus as well. I think it's really important to, in addition to teaching skills, for kids to develop a vocabulary and a passion for all different kinds of music. And in the last couple of years in my work with kids there, I really started noticing that kids knew less and less about the orchestra and knew less and less about the instruments that even play in the orchestra. I had a third grader who said, well, what's a clarinet? And at which point I said, okay, we have to do something about this.
To what do you attribute that? Because there are a lot of things in the world around us, particularly in terms of technology, that would seem to suggest that anybody should be able to access just about anything. Is it that there is so much open to people now that that certain important things just kind of get lost in this blizzard of information? Or are there other things at work here that would explain why fewer and fewer youngsters seem to know anything at all about classical music?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and it's a big question, and probably, you know, has a couple of different answers. But I think in my experience is that children are kind of inundated right now with whatever is put in front of them. And by what I mean by that is, you know, whatever is the latest thing is sort of all over the place. It's on TV and it's advertised online, and kids are very, very interested in interactive things, and so computer games and anything that they're going to do in front of a screen is going to sort of take interest and take their focus. And I think parents right now have a really big responsibility in terms of making sure that their kids are being introduced to the things that they feel are important and that they want them to be introduced to. And if for whatever reason classical music is not on the agenda, then a lot of kids are not really being introduced to it. I noticed that even in my school that a lot of the kids had not been to a symphony, and so we started partnering with the New York Philharmonic in their education school day concerts. And I know that any city that has a symphony orchestra, I'm sure, has a really good education department, and it's a great thing to take advantage of, because a lot of the time those concerts are subsidized and it doesn't really cost a lot to take your kid to a concert. It's really important. But I think also the advance of technology has really kind of eclipsed classical music, which unfortunately is not a great thing.
Right. And of course, if you're seeing that in a place like New York City, we imagine that it might potentially be an even worse problem in some little town in Idaho or North Dakota or some place where there is no symphony in town, and where something like a symphony orchestra is only something you might see a picture of, unless somebody makes a concerted effort to bring this across your path.
It's really true, which is why I was motivated to create Welcome to the Symphony, because I really wanted to reach all kids everywhere, and I thought that if you give them these excerpts of the symphony in sound and you make it immediately gratifying for them, meaning that they can push that button and they can hear the first 20 seconds, that excerpt that you played, and you can hear the last 20 seconds of the first movement, and you can hear all the important themes in the first movement of the Beethoven symphony, then maybe kids will go, oh yeah, well, I want to hear the rest of that, which is exactly what's beginning to happen. That's the feedback that I'm getting. The kids are like, oh, I want to hear that. And the whole idea is exposure often and early, early and often.
We're speaking with Carolyn Sloan, a music educator and composer and writer, about the children's book she has just created called Welcome to the Symphony, a musical exploration of the orchestra using Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. I want to ask you why Beethoven and why Beethoven's Fifth, although, I mean, at a glance, that might seem like an absurd question. I mean, what better place to start with than Beethoven's Fifth, just because it's already such a famous piece? And yet, just because it's famous to the rest of us doesn't necessarily mean that's a great piece with which to try to connect classical music to young people or to get them excited about it. But there's obviously some things about Beethoven's Fifth that you think make it an ideal choice for a book like this. What is it about Beethoven's Fifth that led you to choose it?
I think the very clear and very simple motifs that he introduces in the beginning, the whole rhythmic da-da-da-da, you know, that whole part of it is very easy for kids to grasp right away. And the themes are very distinct and repeat often. And I think that's a key, because when kids can kind of latch on to something they can identify and identify over and over again, the piece becomes familiar to them. And once it becomes familiar to them, then they really like it. And I think, first, I'm a big fan of Beethoven. And, you know, I played a lot of Beethoven as a kid, as a pianist. But I just love the idea of being able to sort of extract those themes and introduce them to kids and have them kind of immediately identifiable.
So when you decided then that it would be Beethoven's Fifth, take us through your thought process in terms of how you actually went about putting the book together and sort of the journey that you take the reader, in a sense, via three small visitors to the concert hall.
Yes. Well, originally the idea was a pretty simple one. I said, okay, well, I want kids to experience what it might be to go to a symphony, since a lot of them haven't really been. What is it going to be like? From the minute that you walk into the hall, what do you see? What do you hear? And, you know, to make that experience really, really kind of a vital and alive one for them, to the end of, like, well, do we clap at the end of the first movement? Oh, no, we don't. So we thought initially that we were going to use a family going to the symphony, and then we thought, no, you know what? Let's use something like these three little mice who can be sitting in the rafters and experiencing it for the first time. And we found that actually sort of tested better with younger readers. So they walk into the concert halls and they sort of see everybody on stage and they hear them tuning. So that, you know, then there's the button that you can push to hear them tune. Then you see the conductor walk on stage and one of them asks, well, who's that guy? Is he late? You know, and then it's sort of explaining everything almost through the eyes and ears of a very young reader, a young child. And then I wanted to be able to sort of pick out those things that would make the piece really exciting for the readers to listen to. And the whole time I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking, well, I don't just want it to be on the page, because quite honestly, as a musician and as a music educator, I had read so many music books to my kids and also to my own son as a parent that had no music, or that had a CD that you had to put into a drive, and now, you know, they don't even make those anymore in your computers. So I wanted it to be very, very accessible. So I said, I want them to hear everything. I want them to hear them tuning. I want them to hear just the violins, and I want them to understand what it means to hear that first 20 seconds, and they're so excited, and they're listening, you know, what happens now? And so, I mean, I'm trying to answer your question in the most complete way I can, but I wanted them to sit and listen to it and experience it the way that they would if they were in a concert hall.
Explain, as you start talking about specific instruments of the orchestra, the added component of sound with this book that can serve as such a nice, tangible introduction for the young reader.
Well, I think so many kids don't know what these instruments are, and they haven't really heard them. And that goes back to these music books that are great, but they don't have that oral component where they can really demonstrate what the instrument sounds like. So what's great about it, I think, is you really start to make connections. Like my students at school would press the violin button, and by the time they got to the double bass, they kind of formed their own observations and conclusions about, oh, well, you know, the smaller instruments have the higher sound, and the larger instruments, they seem to have the lower sound. And then they understand the difference between the different sections in the orchestra. And so they understand that, oh, well, these instruments are responsible for these kinds of themes. But then, oh, we hear that theme again played in this different section with the woodwinds. And a lot of kids have never heard of an oboe or a bassoon. And they not have they not heard it or seen it, but they haven't been able to name it, but they don't know what it sounds like. So to make it really concrete for them is a wonderful thing, I think. Mm-hmm. And immediately, you know, that's the technological part of it. I was like, well, I don't want to do an ebook. I really love kids to have books in their hands. You know, the whole, well, we can talk about fine motor function after, but it's so great for them to be able to hold the book, but then also have the sound, as if they would if they were sitting next to their iPad or their computer.
Absolutely. I am a big fan as well of holding a physical book in one's hand, and it's nice that this book is that, and yet at the same time at the touch of a button allows the young reader to experience some of these moments from the symphony or the sounds of these various instruments. You mention in the afterword of the book that you have a son named Sam.
Yes,
and that you went out of your way to make sure that Sam would be exposed to classical music and you hoped would come to really appreciate it. I'm just curious how old Sam is now and if those efforts to make this a part of his life ultimately sort of took root.
Well, they really did, actually, and I think it they took root so much it surprised me even. He's 19 now, and he's a sophomore at the Manhattan School of Music.
Ah.
And he plays double bass, and actually it's his double bass sound that you're hearing in the book, and a lot of the conservatory students in and around New York City. So we have some of the best young musicians playing the sound files in the book. I did go out of my way for him to learn about the orchestra and classical music because I thought, well, you know, pop music is so ubiquitous and he's going to hear it when he goes to school. I don't need to introduce him to that. You know, of course, my husband is a big fan of the Beatles and different music that we listened to when we were growing up, but we just thought, oh, you know, he'll be able to hear that other stuff. It's on the radio all the time. And little did we know that now he's such a classical music lover, he really listens to classical music more than anything else. But we would play it in the car. I'd play it while, you know, he was taking a bath, or, you know, we would play games to it. We were always playing classical music, and I teach classical piano as well, so he heard a lot of it in the house.
Well, it always makes life better when it's when that kind of music is part of it, and so we encourage people who with young children to think about sharing with them this beautiful book called Welcome to the Symphony, a musical exploration of the orchestra using Beethoven's Symphony No. 5, published by Workman Publishing, and the author, Carolyn Sloan. Carolyn Sloan, it was great to talk with you, and thank you for creating this lovely book, which we hope will open up the world of classical music to a whole host of young readers.
Thank you, Greg.
The time is 8:28, and you are listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Part two of our program with Alvaro Garcia from the University of Wisconsin Parkside is coming up in just a moment. Thank you. It's hard to think of music that would be any more recognizable than that. And for that matter, music, period, that is more recognizable than the main theme from Star Wars. And I think those of us who are old enough to remember when the movie Star Wars came out in the late 1970s can remember how thrilling it was to hear that music played for the very, very first time. And it had us riveted to the screen for the adventures that followed, of course, thereafter, with originally three films and then three more films. And, of course, as many of you know, a brand new seventh Star Wars film is about to be released to the general public. And there's already a delirious amount of interest and excitement about that, as well as nervous anticipation. Well, I don't know to what extent it was planned, but certainly it is a brilliant stroke of genius on somebody's part that the next concert of the UW Parkside Orchestra and Community Orchestra is going to feature prominently music of John Williams from Star Wars. And I'm really happy to have with me in the studios today Alvaro Garcia, who is the conductor of the Parkside Orchestras. He's going to be presiding over Saturday night's concert. Saturday night, right?
Correct, correct.
A concert which is devoted actually entirely to music from film, although it includes a couple of pieces at least that certainly were not composed by Luigi Boccherini or George Frederick Handel with any notion of motion pictures or their music being utilized in film. And most of the program is going to be turned over to the great John Williams with a brief sampling from E.T. and then a massive suite drawn from Star Wars and primarily that very, very first film, which, of course, set all of this in motion. And I'm really excited to have Alvaro Garcia with me today to talk about this concert and to talk very specifically about some of the music that John Williams crafted for these films. And we're going to play excerpts from each of these main themes and kind of pick them apart a little bit. And hopefully you will come away from this with an even deeper appreciation for this exciting and very familiar music. Alvaro Garcia, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm just fine, and so excited to be talking with you today about something that I think is such an interesting topic. First of all, tell us about the timing of this to be playing music of Star Wars. I am assuming it's not just pure coincidence.
Somewhat. I guess it will be a part of coincidence, but when of course we plan our seasons about a year ahead of time, and when we are planning for I was planning for this season, I thought that once every 4 to 5 years is kind of an educational theme for our students too, that I put in the program some sort of a pops concert, so they are well aware what pops music means when you go out in the world, the orchestral world, and what it means to play pops music. And they are learning that it's not as easy as perhaps a Mozart or a Handel to play pops music anymore. So when I constructed this concert, I wanted to do a concert dedicated to the movies, and I didn't have much of a direction going through until I decided to set on my sets on Star Wars, and not thinking at the time, I think, that a new Star Wars movie was about to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I'm talking about probably March, April last year, and I think, to my knowledge, I have no idea there was another Star Wars movie coming up. It was all after I decided to do that piece of music that it was available for us to actually be able to perform the suite as part of the John Williams Signature Edition that they are coming out now, that I realized that all the things that they were going behind Star Wars as the movie releases, we have one coming in December. Apparently, there's another one coming next year, even in the next December. So I didn't have that much of a concept. So, yes, there is a part of coincidence there.
Wow.
Into that. And so when I decided to create this program, then I decided to divide it into two halves. One, the second half of the program, which is the fully orchestral part of the program, that is going to be dedicated to the soundtracks of the movies, some music created for specific movies, while the first half is classical music that was used during movies. Right. So yes, when we are talking about the Boccherini, and is the night watch of the military night watch in Madrid, kind of a Spanish music, really interesting piece, string quintet actually. It's a piece that the Pasacalle Los Manolos is actually the final duo that you see in the movie Master and Commander by Russell Crowe.
Which is one of the best movies made in the last 15 years. I think it was a masterpiece. And I remember at the time, among many things I loved about the film, was the really intriguing musical score,
yes,
which drew upon a lot of different possibilities. And so I'm really anxious, actually, to go back to my DVD and find this moment in the the film to re-experience it.
The moment of the movie will be at the very end, actually, when the two, kind of the captain, Russell Crowe, and his first lieutenant or so, they are playing these duets, violin and cello. And there is another duet in the middle of the movie in which they play kind of the last movement of the violin, Mozart's Violin Concerto Number 3, so as part of that. And then in my concert, then we move into the Handel Concerto Grosso Opus 6 Number 12, in which the aria was used in actually several movies, but most recently was in Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl. And you know, coincidentally, again, both movies, Master and Commander and the Pirates of the Caribbean movie, was both released in 2003. So, and this is that aria, that cavatina aria that it has in the middle that it shows very briefly in the movie. But it's how the experience, the adventure that I see in this concert is how people are willing to use classical music already composed for other purposes into their music, as well as they are constructing new music for those movies.
Right, and it's intriguing to see how both can work really well, and many scores have both original and adapted music, even side by side, and a really good composer knows how to use all of that effectively.
Sure.
So let's talk about Mr. John Williams, and I know that you have done a little bit of study.
The regular research you do, as any conductor will do, behind it. That's the second part of the program, is dedicated to John Williams. So the first piece of the program will be the flying theme of E.T. And for that, we are using an arrangement by Paul Hart, because the arrangement has several times the theme coming through, while the John Williams Signature Edition only has the flying theme at the very end for like about 10-15 seconds.
And you want people to really be able to hear this music and fully enjoy it. I thought it would be fun to listen to it for a few seconds, but maybe ahead of that, just say a word about what you think John Williams manages to achieve in this wonderful music, and maybe just a word or two about how he achieves that, whatever that effect might be.
Well, generally speaking, I mean, one of the things that John Williams puts in all the construction of all his movies is he pays very close attention to the motions, and he always thinks about how to, project that emotion through the music, so the music becomes a carrier of that emotion. So if for a second, if you could imagine the movie scene of E.T. with the little kid and the bike, E.T. in the basket in front of the bike, and starts flying off, and you take the music away, all of a sudden it becomes the most dry adventure you probably can think. And it's how he projects those emotions of people, and he's very careful of that. So the way he uses the brass actually to carry the powerful melodic lines, when you have all the excitement underlining the strings, that's generally speaking how he tends to build and construct his music throughout. But it's just this big powerful feeling, in a sense very much romanticized, so it gets a very deep connection to all people of all ages when you are looking at the audience.
And I think you're right, if you could look at this, some of these images, and they would have a certain very limited impact, and then you stir in this wonderful music by John Williams, and suddenly we are talking about magic.
Yes.
So here's just a little bit of the famous flying scene from E.T. And this is the music, of course, of John Williams. You know, this this music reminds me in a tiny way of the Ride of the Valkyries from Die Walküre, and one of the hallmarks of that famous music is that there's almost nothing down in the bass. I mean, it's just all in a sense flying stuff. There's this airiness to it because Wagner sort of avoids any big thumping down in below. And John Williams doesn't quite do that, but he's very sparing in how much he puts on the bottom of the texture. It's all about violins and flutes and so on. And
yes, and in this very passages where you have the melody and the violins, for example, you have just the engine motor on the horns by doing those eighth notes pa 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 continuously, while you have in the bass pom. Pom pom, very light, and then a unison in the strings, just carrying the full power of the melody with that excitement on the flute, fast moving passages in the flute going through. So it's just the way is constructed. I mean, it's just fantastic. I mean, one thing that we had to realize is that John Williams, and I don't know in E.T. so much, but in Star Wars, they had to be able to do music really quickly. So he used orchestrators working in tandem with him, but he will always coordinate the orchestration and tell them exactly what to do. So the orchestration portion of John Williams, I mean, you go from every single movie, you start drawing common characteristics in between all those movies, whether you are looking at Harry Potter, the first three movies, or you are looking at Jurassic Park. Again, those all these big romanticized melodies that you get through and makes immediate connection from the public to the audience.
Right. We learn to recognize these sort of signature tunes, signature themes, and it draws us into the film in a very, very powerful way. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Alvaro Garcia, who is the orchestra conductor at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And this Saturday night, the Parkside Orchestra and Community Orchestra are going to be playing a concert devoted to movie music, and the second half of the concert is devoted to John Williams, and specifically to a brief excerpt from E.T., and then to a suite drawn from the first of the Star Wars movies, which is actually Episode 4. I don't remember the official.
A New Hope.
A New Hope. There we go. So let's talk a little bit about these excerpts that you're going to be playing from Star Wars. And maybe ahead of that, we were just comparing notes and the fact that I'm old enough to remember when this movie came out. I was in high school. You were a toddler.
I'm a toddler.
Yeah. But of course, you evidently saw this film via VHS tape or something not too long thereafter.
Yes,
just say a word about the impact that this film had on you. And by the way, were you in Spain at the time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You know, I left Spain when I was 24. So, I mean, by then I had the full realization of all the, at least first three Star Wars movies at the time. And you had to realize that this saga, in a sense, when each movie is being released, the first one is 77, the second one is 80-something, I don't remember quite well right now. But, you know, the second movie is what caught my eye, in a sense, and I remember all little kids going crazy with these new toys, I mean, and we were trying to see who had the latest toy of Star Wars at the time. And in a sense, it's kind of funny how you connect to the second movie, but without barely seeing the first one yet. And then it's when you had to come back, oh, hold on a minute, let me go back and figure out what happened. Because things are, you know, they are offset by a good amount of years. So it's how, generationally speaking, people are getting engulfed into the movies.
Right, into its whole mythology. And,
Yeah, and mythology. And then it's very interesting, of course, how to see how the characters are changing across the movies and the story. And the
yeah, part. Fascinating. And, of course, John Williams' score, it's just extraordinary what he manages to achieve. And I suspect for a whole lot of people, this was maybe the first film where they fully understood the impact that a musical score has. I mean, perhaps on some subliminal level, maybe they understood that before, but really came to understand that, I think, in a little more spectacular fashion with these films.
Yes, and you know, we had to understand a little bit, too, that around the 1960s, Hollywood, the movie industry, filmmaking, the music they were using for their scores was very minimal at that time, to the point because they wanted to get to a very realistic point of view. And, of course, in reality, when you go through the streets, there is no music sounding in your ears. And therefore, they kept their scoring to a minimum at that point. But then for the 70s, and as you know, they put it, John Williams and Steven Spielberg, they say, thank God, during the 70s, there was a change to really start using back music to, again, to project those emotions, project that action, that events going on in the movie, as much as perhaps opera did at the time of Wagner and the time of Verdi, that they were using, you know, the orchestra as the carrier, in a sense, of the action.
Right, and of the emotion.
And the emotion, very, yeah, and obviously that translated even to the post-Wagnerian, when you talk about Puccini.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. So let's listen to just a little bit again of what we heard at the very start of this, namely the main theme of from Star Wars. I think for me, what I especially love is the kind of the turbulence of the melodic line, the
those leaps.
Yeah, those leaps of a seventh, which is so so exciting. It gives it such wonderful energy. What do you want to highlight here before we just play a few moments from it?
No, it's just how, I mean, the powerful of the brass as kind of a new element that breaks frontiers to a new space, new horizon that we have never experienced before. That's kind of how it opens. And this main title is used through the initial credits of the movie. And we haven't seen anything. It's just a bunch of words over a stellar background,
right,
in a sense. So is that, you know, encompasses all the excitement of something that we have never seen and we are about to see.
Hmm. Here it is, just a few moments of that main theme from Star Wars, the music of John Williams. Oh, music, it evokes from back in the 30s and early 40s, the swashbuckling epics of Errol Flynn with the music of Eric Wolfgang Korngold, like Seahawk and Captain Blood. I mean, John Williams is tapping into something very visceral when he creates that that wonderful theme. I know the Star Wars suite that you're going to be playing moves from that to music that could not be more different, Princess Leia's theme. Just say a quick word about some of the really exquisite things that John Williams does here.
Yes, this is very interesting now, and not from the point of view of just this suite. I mean, this suite just encompasses just the first movie with the addition of the Yoda's theme that we'll later hear. But what is more important and more interesting here is that this Leia's theme is the same melody that John Williams will use through the movie, yes, to propel any love theme or any tender moment in the action. So it's not just proprietary to just the love of Leah, let's put it that way. I mean, it serves the purposes of the love of Leah here, that later on it will be actually really happen, not only until the third movie, in The Return of the Jedi, in this saga where that happens. So Leah's theme is used as part of her, the tenderness of what Princess Leah is. But if you look even to the new movies, the 2000 movies, the first three movies of this saga, in a sense, is like how that love theme by Senator Amidala and young Anakin Skywalker, it represents, is just transformed, but it's coming from the same thing, and he's using the same techniques as much as the techniques that Wagner used to use for the leitmotifs back in his operas.
The Wagner operas and the themes in the Ring cycle, yes. We often, when we talk about the music of Star Wars, the difference is Darth Vader's music is always Darth Vader's music, and he doesn't tinker with some of those big themes, but that there are other cases, and you're absolutely right, where he actually takes those themes and works with them and transforms them according to what the scene is or what needs to be conveyed, and that's a real master at work, bet.
And in this case, in this movie, is very interesting. The introduction is kind of becomes more modernist to become, yes, again, the post-romantic later on when the theme is introduced by the horn and later on on the flute. And the
Let's hear some of Princess Leia's theme. Exquisite music by John Williams, and incredibly difficult.
Incredibly difficult. I mean, you are talking about a horn going to a high D and having to make it that exquisite and that simple, because it sounds very simple, is just fantastic.
Mm.
Fantastic scoring.
Here is contrasting then the next movement, which is the Imperial March, which, of course, this is the bad guy's music, and in particular, the baddest of the bad guys, Darth Vader. Quick word about what John Williams does here in the Imperial March.
To me, it's interesting. And maybe I'm going here in a limb, Greg, and if you think I'm wrong, you can correct me. But, you know, this is the theme that pretty much we all know that once you hear those three, four notes, Darth Vader is going to come into the scene. But most likely, I mean, if you see all the saga, you see that theme is used for all things evil or something that is turning bad. Always you have a reminder of that thing coming through. And in a sense, and this is me going on in that limb a little bit, is that you have a three-note motion followed by an interval going downwards. And you just recently played a short story in your show talking about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which pretty much is about three notes and then an interval.
Right.
Going down. And we know from that score is fate calling at your door. So I wonder sometimes, in my mind, what is the connection, if there is any, to be there for that purpose?
Interesting idea. Here it is. And, of course, one of the most intriguing figures in the whole Star Wars saga is that of Yoda, a figure who actually I don't think we meet actually till the Empire Strikes Back, but
yes,
his theme appears in this suite. Just say a word about the Yoda's
this
theme.
This is the score that we are performing on Saturday night at 7:30 is the concert. The score, it was actually created for the 20th celebration, so it will be in 1997, the 20th celebration of the Star Wars, the release of the first movie. And then John Williams, just to complete the score, he decided to add Yoda's theme into the mix, although Yoda wasn't part of that first movie. What we have to consider is that through the saga, Yoda's theme is kind of the representative, not only Yoda as a character, but also anything that has to do with Jedi power or the Force, in a sense, is that the good part of the Force. That's Yoda's theme. That's what it represents.
Right, and that makes sense then in the suite for the Imperial March to be followed by this lovely music. Gorgeous, gorgeous music. That's Yoda's theme. And before we hear the final motion, a movement from this suite, which is the throne room scene, which is at the very end of the movie, I know you have a quick word to say about the process by which this score took shape.
We have to understand that the process of writing for film is kind of different of the composer just sitting, regular composer sitting on his desk and writing on his own leisure so. I mean, when John Williams had to write for this music, he only had 7 weeks to write and orchestrate the whole music for the movie, and that's the first movie. And then they have 9 days of recording session with the London Symphony. So you are under tremendous pressure to the point that John Williams had to write 3 minutes of music every day for those initial 7 weeks.
Wow.
And while he's writing all these sketches, then he has an orchestrator working with him to actually orchestrate everything that will he review the following day. So the process is just amazing.
Wow.
And again, the music here is so important, even in the throne room, because if you play the movie with no sound in the throne room scene, really, you see people walking for like about 4 minutes.
Absolutely.
Nothing, no dialogue, no nothing. So really, music is the one that carries the whole action. So without music, this movie would have been basically nothing,
right,
to my view.
It's a wonder what he managed to achieve. So music from Star Wars of John Williams is going to be featured Saturday night in this concert by the orchestras of UW Parkside, and that will be in the Francis Bedford Recital
Concert
Hall.
Correct, at 7:30.
Absolutely beautiful space. 7:30 Saturday night. Alvaro Garcia will be on the podium. Thank you so much, Maestro, for joining us for what has been a really, really fun hour, and best wishes with Saturday night's concert.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Our weather forecast is for cloudy, windy, mild conditions with light rain on and off all day with a high of 60 degrees. All the way down to 38 degrees for an overnight low tonight under cloudy skies. Winds will continue. Tomorrow should be sunny, actually, but very windy and a high of just 46 degrees. Friday's high, 43 degrees, with light snow in the forecast for the late afternoon. A 50% chance of light snow on Saturday with a high of 33.